right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. We're here at Studio Fist in Your Face in lovely the Granary District of Salt Lake City with another fantastic panel and studio audience. Welcome, everybody. Well, we're hitting the countdown. I think that we're down to, I think, five maybe episodes that I have left. I was going to record one on December 3rd, but I'm going to be out of town, so we'll bring in a suitable substitute for the night. But if you want to catch the last of the John Larson era, your time is quickly coming to an end. Speaking of the end or the beginning of an era, I need to remind you all that we are in the midst of our fundraiser. If you go over to MormonExpression.com or WhitefieldsEducational.org, up in the top right-hand corner, there's a little widget that'll take you over to the site that we're using to do the fundraiser. Now, what we're trying to do is we are trying to collect before the end of this year all of the funds that it takes to operate this particular studio. And this studio is used, of course, for Mormon Expression, for the Reasonability Podcast, for the Mormon Expression Voices Podcast. We do group therapy sessions here. We have educational classes. There's a great one coming up in 2 days. You should all come out to if you want about the Utah art scene. There's a lot of fabulous things. And what we're going to do when we hit this this goal, because I know we can hit it with your help, is we are going to open the studio up for use as a community center for anybody who's doing anything that fits within our charter, which is basically helping people achieve positive social interaction and positive identity outside of fundamentalist religion. So we're going to open this up for free for anybody who wants to do anything in the Salt Lake area who needs a space. If you live in Salt Lake or in anywhere in the Mormon corridor, you know, one of the biggest tragedies here is the church builds these enormous, beautiful chapels, these buildings that have stages and kitchens and tons of facility, and they just lock them up all the time. And the amount of real estate and money that the church spends on these buildings to basically not allow people to use them has always been heartbreaking for me. And in my own little way, in my own little corner of the world, I want to combat that by allowing this space to be open for anybody who can find a decent use for it. So we want this space to be filled up as much as we possibly can. So with your help, we can continue. And that takes some of the financial pressure off of the podcast to try to collect the funds themselves in order to pay for the rent. So if you've enjoyed this and you want to find a way to serve, all this money is going straight. We're earmarking it completely to paying the rent, paying for the Wi-Fi, that sort of things. And it's not going to any person. So if you want to find a way to support and you're afraid that we're all getting rich off of your hard-earned money, this is a way to donate and not worry about me buying donuts with your cash. So go check that out. Well, let's introduce our panel. Nathan, you are an old friend of mine. We've known each other for, what, 7, 8 years? Been that long?
Probably about that.
Nathan is here almost every night.
Not every night. We're talking every week.
That you record.
Oh, you're not here like all the time? I thought... because I've just got a report that there's like a strange sort of creepy guy that's been hanging out around the glass, and I just always thought it was you. I'm kind of embarrassed. I'm sorry, Nathan. Now, Nathan, I'm sure people have noticed that you talk a little different than a lot of people.
That's true. Most people don't have the range of vocabulary I do have, and they might still be valid people.
They might be valid people, but the thing that you're all missing, the greatest charm of Nathan, is Nathan is the greatest hand talker that ever existed, and we just need to film you for a while so that they can all get the full extent. Now, Nathan, you have had for quite a few years MS, multiple sclerosis, right?
That's true.
And that's what sort of slows your speaking down a little bit.
That's inconvenient.
Yeah, it is inconvenient. But you're still sharp-witted, and you're a fantastic guy. And I've always wondered if people wonder, like, why is this guy, he doesn't sound like he's 90 years old, but he kind of does. And that's Nathan. So I appreciate you you coming here, and you're sitting on the panel tonight.
I'm in the fabulous seat, or...
Oh, yeah, you're in the fabulous seat to my left. So I have a story about Nathan. He was on the first conference review that we ever did back in 2009. You won't know it because I had to edit him out because he was so fucking drunk during the whole thing that most of it hit the edit bay floor. Do you remember this or did you black out?
Yeah.
Where you guys were
still trying to live it down.
You were with Devin. Where you guys were playing like a conference drinking game, right?
He told me a shot whenever, whatever. What I learned at the end was he wasn't taking a shot.
Oh, Devin wasn't taking shots. Shot. Wait, what, you guys were taking a shot on what criteria?
Oh, it was going to be, at least I remember we definitely had even.
Oh, even. The word even, which is why he was drunk. All right. Well, I love you, Nathan. I'm happy to have you on the panel tonight. Of course, an old friend's been on many times, and he's one of the cohorts on reasonability, our friend Brian. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me. It's fun to be here. I haven't done a Mormon Expression podcast in quite a while.
Yeah, yeah. And you're doing a doubleheader tonight. I think – what are we talking about? Oh, we're talking about Godwin's Law.
Godwin's Law, yeah.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. So welcome, Brian.
Thanks.
And an old friend, has been on several times. Flip, welcome back.
Hi.
I noticed you're shooting double barrels this evening. He's got them both locked and loaded, both bottles open.
Well, I figured I'd need one. My throat was a little dry on the way over. I wanted to be prepared.
Somebody is not doing their service to me here right now. All right, so that's our panel. Let's jump right into the news. One big story. Sometimes the stories hit the news feed, the Mormon news feed, and I don't see it all the time. Every Tuesday afternoon, I go and I look and find the news stories. Some of them I've heard of, and some of them I haven't. This one I hadn't really heard of. But sometimes they just make you laugh because you say, really? We were that fucked up? We were really that bad? The Mormon Church announced that now Mormon mothers with children in the home, as well as members who have been previously divorced, can now be hired to teach Seminary Institute. So let's reverse that. Until like 3 days ago, if you were a woman that had children at home, they would actually ask you this. Now, this is why the First Amendment in the United States needs to be amended, by the way. Because everywhere else in the country, you cannot discriminate, you can't discriminate against a woman based on the age of her children. This would be illegal in the United States. Except if you're a religion. Then we have special exemption. The whole religious exemption in the Constitution is basically a law that allows religions to be douchebags. That's all it does. Because every other right is protected, right? The right of assembly, the right of free speech, you know, all that stuff is already assembled. So we have the right of the freedom of religion just to allow religions to be dicks. So you honestly, if you were a woman who had kids at home, they wouldn't hire you on the grounds that your kids were too young. And if you'd been divorced, it didn't matter how long you'd been married. You know, you could have gotten married for like a year, gotten divorced, been married to your current partner for 40 years. The church says, fuck you, you're tarnished, right?
Yeah, lick cupcake, baby. Forget you.
Does the divorce criteria apply only to the women then?
I think the divorce criteria applied to both.
I think it's both.
It's a great question.
The thing is, if you're a seminary teacher, then you're a good, faithful Mormon person who, like all good, faithful Mormons, are receiving blessings left and right. And you can't explain to the 14-year-olds that, well, yeah, I was divorced and my life is still okay.
This speaks to the duplicity oftentimes the church does. And if you get involved with apologetics, apologists, you'll see this all the time, where the church talks out of both sides of its mouth. And this is one of those instances where they allow divorced people to ostensibly go to the temple, have a temple recommend. So according to on paper, you're a member in full standing. But there's a lot of, and I think it used to be practiced that you couldn't be a bishop if you've been divorced. Now, this is really sketchy because I think I one time did research. I don't remember. Out of the 14 or 15 prophets of the church, like 7 of them had been divorced. It's because when you marry 40 women, statistically, you're going to get divorced to 7 of them. I mean, it's just, you know, playing the odds. And these guys had a lot of divorce. They don't talk about that very often, but in the polygamy, there was tons of fucking divorce. And so it's been kind of a sketchy rule, but it's one of those things like for a long time until the church ordered it, they didn't let women pray. Say the opening prayer in sacrament meeting. And then in like, in the 80s, they changed that. Now you wouldn't find that on paper in the 80s. You might find it on paper in the 60s.
A woman didn't say a prayer in general conference until like, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah, yeah.
2 months ago.
Well, and have they said the opening prayer yet? Because for a long time it was women
can't just
didn't
trust
pray,
that to anybody.
And then women could only close it because I don't know. So here's that. The battle's over. The church has lost the war. They're changing things so quickly now. And you know, like when you have rats in your garage and they tell you to be careful sweeping so you don't get hantavirus or whatever. Because you put all the vaporized rat shit in the air. So the fact that the church is now sweeping shows that they know they have a big problem, right? And it's that we're going to quickly reach the tipping point. And the tipping point is when the exit will be starting to happen so quickly that the church will just start grasping. They'll start doing a hyper reform. They'll start reforming everything they can that they don't have to hold on to doctrinally.
9% tithing.
And we haven't reached the tipping point, but we've started on the field, right? I can see that now. And where I see this happening, 10 years ago when I first got involved in like the post-Mormon communities, people would come out to these groups. We have group meetings at the library or wherever, and people would come out and they would say, oh, there's, you know, it's such a relief to finally meet other people who, you know, are normal, intelligent people who've left the church, that there's other people like me. You won't find a lot of those groups. Those groups don't have the same sort of strength they do. Now, outside, you know, like in Phoenix or in Portland, you'll see stronger groups, but you don't find them in Salt Lake City anymore. Used to 10 years ago, but the so many people are now leaving the church and walking away from the church. I remember people coming out and saying, I didn't know that people left the church. You won't find anybody who says that now because you can't find anybody who doesn't know somebody who's left the church now. And you won't find a ward where they can't tell you about a family that's not left the church. I have personally witnessed the change in paradigm, and the tipping point is going to come when all the things like this don't matter because so many people be leaving the church that it'll just seem really normal, like a normal thing to do.
Well, one of the strengths that they had, you know, before the internet really came about is they could vilify, in really dark, evil ways, people who were apostates, right? They have every reason to fear the apostate because the apostate doesn't like them and they know where the warts are. But that's really hard to say that, apostates are unhappy, miserable people now because there are tons of people who have left the church or are just as happy and successful and doing all sorts of fun things and living their lives in ways that the mudslinging just doesn't stick and it makes them look like liars.
For sure. And I think that's what's leading to a lot of this reform. I mean, why now? When you read something like that, it's 2014. If you haven't been hiring women with small children to be seminary teachers, why now? Well, it's not because God told them to. It's because they're afraid how they look. They know there's a spotlight on them. I know this is conjecture on my part, so be it. But, it's so many reform, and they're trying to throw bones, right? That New York Times and you know, NPR and these big news, respectable news outlets just are watching every move the church has made, and the church is not used to that. The church is really used to controlling their message. You know, when I watched the old Hinckley, and Hinckley was a media sort of mastermind, but he really was good at controlling the message because people didn't know any better, right?
And it was difficult to look up in the late 80s and 90s.
Right. And it was difficult to find people, you know, who can give you the other side. And, you know, they bungle things like the Kate Kelly affair and, you know, just keep going. Like I keep saying this podcast, just let the church keep talking. No, just let them keep doing
it. Do we have any idea about what seminary teachers is? It might just be that they also just need to open it up because they can't fill the need. I mean, how many people, I remember talking to seminary teachers. They didn't have money. They drove very bad cars. And they seemed worried a lot.
So a lot of Utah, miraculously, we talk about miracles. There is a miracle that happens in Utah, which is every time the state finds land to build either a junior high school or a high school, miraculously, there is a suitable plot of land right next door because the state could not possibly be involved in building seminaries for those who aren't Mormon.
Sometimes it looks like they even got the same contractor.
Sometimes it looks like that, doesn't it? And
they got the same chairs inside, the same tables.
And they are often launched on exactly the same day. They, yes, it's almost miraculously as if there's coordination between the state and the church, which couldn't be.
No, it's just tender
mercies. We know, because that's illegal. That's against – so it has to be a miracle. There's no other possible explanation.
Tender mercies. That's it.
Exactly. Anyway, what bullshit thing were we saying before we got about this?
It's hard to keep track.
Seminary teachers.
Seminary teachers. Yeah. So in Utah, there's a cadre of every high school of 8 full-time teachers. And then if you go other places in the Mormon corridor – like Phoenix or, you know, Seattle, there'll be full time. Well, they're paid, but they teach early morning seminary. And then if you go way out into the hinterlands, like you belong to the one and only branch in Connecticut, you know, they'll have somebody that they just give a calling to. But a lot of seminary teachers are in fact paid. Our good friend Mike Tannehill is a paid seminary teacher in Henderson, Nevada. And he does early morning seminary.
The other thing, talking about religious special protection, because the whole thing with the seminaries here in school is that everybody knows that, like, there's one period a day that all the Mormon kids disappear and walk across the thing and then come back. And, you know, well, what is this? Well, built into the program in Utah, you've got this optional hour, right? And so, like, everybody else would just get, like, an independent study period, but no credit or whatever. And the things I remember asking, like, you know, so wait a second. It's just an hour that we get to go do whatever. So, like, what if a bunch of us wanted to go find a responsible adult and go to the park and bang on a drum? You know, like, no, you can't do that. And that's the weird thing, that, like, it's supposedly this open hour for kids to do whatever and beneficial thing they can. But no, it's just about the fucking church and nothing else.
Release time. Wink, wink.
In all defense, this saves the state a lot of money. because for any, you know, if you have a 5A high school,
reduces class size for sure.
Students, approximately 200 of those students are off campus at a given time. So,
like, in principle, you could go and say, like, well, hey, I just want to take actual credit hour that hour. And they basically, at least when I was in school, they actively dissuaded you from doing that because it would result in you graduating early. And that's the last thing they fucking want kids doing, is getting out of high school and moving on with their lives.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So that's the church. Yeah. Congratulations, Mormon mothers with children. You can now teach seminary. All right. That's the news.
The Mormon Expression podcast has called Studio Fist in Your Face its home for the last year. What many of you may not know is that the studio is a part of the Whitefields Educational Foundation Community Center. We're currently raising funds to cover our operating costs for the community center for 2015 so that we can keep the community center open. The community center studio hosts the Mormon Expression podcast, Mormon Expression Voices, and the Reasonability podcast. Additionally, the space is utilized for our group counseling sessions. We'd like to reach out to you to help us cover our operating costs for 2015 so that we can keep the studio open. If our operating goals are met for 2015, the community center will also be opened up to the community at large to host any events that align with the Whitefield Educational Foundation mission statement at no cost. We'd ask you to please consider donating to help keep the community center open. If you're interested in donating or would just like some more information, you can visit mormonexpression.com or whitefieldseducational.org and click the banner located in the upper right-hand corner. Thank you so much for your consideration, and we hope to see you in 2015.
So our news topic relates to our topic of discussion tonight. Kind of coming near the end of the podcast. So there are a few points or the people, every time I say that, then people panic. The end of the podcast as me with the host. We're good.
May it live forever.
So one of those things, that's sort of been on my mind for a lot of years is what would the church look like if it were actually true? Now, It's an interesting mental exercise. And actually, scientists and philosophers do this sort of thing all the time. I was listening to a book, last night talking about some of the mental exercise like Newton and folks, you know, went through. So this is a common sort of intellectual exercise to say, what would the church look like if it were actually true? Because then if the church looks like what it would look like if it were actually true, well, then by gum, you have a good solid sort of indicator that the church might in fact be true. But if it doesn't look like that, then you might want to ask some questions. You might want to think about it a little bit.
Well, this is an essential concept of science generally. It's called falsifiability. It's the ability to make a prediction that would demonstrate whether a thing is correct, and you should also be able to make a prediction whether or not a thing is false.
You're absolutely right. Okay. So I have made my list of 10 things, 10 categoric things. But first we want to talk about the validity of religion. Because I already know how people are going to object to my list. There's a concept in science called validity. And it's not just a tosser word. It's an actual thing. A valid theory is one that is internally consistent and consistent with the data. Okay. So, we would say that the theory of evolution is a valid theory. It's not self-contradictory, and it matches pretty much. No scientific theory matches all the data. We haven't come up with one of those yet. But for the most part, it matches the majority of the data. So it's the best theoretical explanation we have for the biological evidence we have, the theory of evolution.
It also makes good predictions. It's an essential thing that a valid theory must do.
It does, in fact. So, but valid means it's consistent. It makes sense. It's a logical theory. So if we had, say, the Talmudic, model of the, heavens, that the heavens circle around the earth, right? Well, that's not the one of the problems is it's not a valid theory. It is a theory out there, and it was held by a lot of people for a long time, but it's not valid.
It matched the data, right? A thing can be valid without being true necessarily, right?
Well, it matched the data to some extent. We get more data
than we had at the time.
We looked theoretically, and it did even then have some internal inconsistencies, right?
Retrograde. Oh, no.
So we can say a religion, and this is something – I looked to see if anybody's ever written about this. As far as I know, I made this up, but somebody can probably – We can say a religion is valid if the religion follows its own predictions or follows its own teachings, right? So for example, if the Mormon church said, well, only men can have the priesthood, but then you could show that the second prophet of the church was a woman, you'd say, well, this is an invalid religion. It's not following its own rules. It's not logically coherent. So when we go down this list of what we would expect to see, we would expect to see that from the church's own standards for itself. Okay? So this is a problem I have with a lot of evangelicals when they criticize the church. Because they will criticize the church based on their own evangelical doctrines, right? For example, they will point out that the church is not a valid Christian church because they don't accept the Trinity. Well, who the fuck says they have to accept the Trinity? That's just what the evangelicals say. That's not a tenet of Mormonism. Or another one that I like to point out is they say Mormons aren't Christians because they want to, they believe righteousness comes from making money. You bet they do. That's part of the tenet of their faith. And it's perfectly consistent with Mormonism to say a righteous man gets lots of money and lots of wives and that's cool. That's part of Mormonism. And you can't criticize Mormonism for that. At least, well, you can.
Well, sure, you can, right? You say, well, no, the Bible says through faith you're, it's through grace you're saved, not by works. And then they skirt the issue and say, no.
But you're doing an external. You're not really holding Mormonism to its own standards, is what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. Mormonism can be.
Only if you count the Bible and then you.
Mormonism can be valid, just like our scientific theories are valid if they're internally consistent. Because you can go and say, I have another theory, a theorem over here that contradicts with that. But then you're talking about the competition of different theories. So I'm sort of laying religions out just like scientific theories. So you think about Mormonism like a scientific theory. And as long as it's a paradigm that's consistent, then you could say Mormonism is valid. I think there are valid religions out there, and they're usually valid partly because they don't define things real solidly. I think Buddhism tends to be a valid religion. It's got a consistent internal
view. Yeah, but it's so nebulous. There's not much to believe in, right? The more specific your claim, the more evidence you need to make it. If you don't make specific claims, you don't
I agree
make
with
much
that.
Evidence.
But so if you – that's part of the point though. If you make specific claims, you're locking yourself in.
Oh, yeah.
Right. You can be a perfectly valid practicing Buddhist without believing any impossible things.
I think that's right.
I have a friend who's a Buddhist and that's – you know, he doesn't really believe in supernatural things, but he's a very serious, deadly, serious Buddhist. And – but yeah, he doesn't believe in goofy stuff.
Yeah, but I mean
he's
if you believe –
a chemist.
If you believe that – God exists, has a beard and a penis, you've got a lot to explain before you get, like, that's a high hurdle to get over.
No, he's hiding.
Agreed.
I don't have to explain anything.
So I came up, well, I was talking to my good friend Dean Paul, that we had lunch together today, and we came up with a model. So I attribute this to Dean Paul. And I'm going to illustrate my theory of validity. Star Wars is not a valid, it doesn't have a valid theory. Here, I'll explain why.
Midichlorians are crap.
The Thetans, right?
That's right.
It's when you take the last four movies,
five and six.
Declare episode numbers. So episode four, everybody knows the new
episode
hope.
Episode four, five, and six lay out this universe, right? And there are certain laws in the universe and certain things that happen. And then they went ahead and made the other movies in which they violated the things. For example, in episode 4, 5, and 6, like they struggle with the Force. These are Jedi masters and they struggle with the Force to lift things around. But you go watch episode 1, 2, and 3 and they can fucking jump like 200 feet in the air. And like in
Well, look, if you killed all the scientists in our modern world, we'd struggle to make a transistor, right?
Right.
They killed all the Jedi, so all that's left is like a guy that only has a fraction of the knowledge, and it's kind of tricky.
So the movies themselves, what I'm saying is if you wanted to try to construct this worldview of Star Wars, you would find that it contradicts itself just based on the movies. If this is true here from episode 1, then this can't be true over here. And then it also sets things up where, you know, for example, spoilers. So in episode 3, Darth Vader walks into this preschool and slaughters children, right?
He was still Anakin then.
Yeah, that was awful.
No, he was Darth Vader then. He just didn't have the – He didn't have the.
No, the transformation mask. Was incomplete.
So he's a really bad guy. I mean, think about that. Think about slaughtering children, right? And then he saves his son, who's his own son, right? Like he's acting in self-interest, and then he gets redeemed at the end just by saving his own son, right? So you look at that and say, I don't want to live in that universe. I don't want to live in the universe where it's okay to kill people. Then at the very end, save your son and then you're redeemed.
I don't know. Don't you ever have the situation where like you're driving down 215, somebody crosses that double yellow line to HOV lane. And you're like, ah, asshole. And then once in a while, you're like, oh, shit, that's my exit. You got to cross over yourself.
Genocide of Darth Vader with crossing the HOV lane?
Pretty much. I see them at – no. Okay. So like you break rules according to your whims and the needs of the moment.
so be it. But then we would have to say, does Mormonism allow for that? Okay. So I'm setting up here to already to deal with the
Wait, are you asking, is Darth Vader in hell? Or is he telestial?
He's Mormon hell, though.
And why is he young, but Obi-Wan and Yoda are old? They got fucked over in their reincarnation of the Force, right?
Yeah. How come he's not like 25 and hot? Rip off.
Right, like Yoda was 25 time.
That's the re-edit, though. The original, he was an old man. I think it was even, what's his name, David Pruse? What's the guy? The guy who actually walked around in the suit who wasn't James Earl.
The big tall guy?
Yeah.
I
don't
know. All right, we're geeking out way, way too much. All right, so back on track. So there are those who will say, with the objections that I'm going to give, to say, well, the church, look, we teach good things. But the church ultimately, there's no guarantee of reward or any sign or any indication the church has to do anything in this life, right? Because we have an eternal time scale. And I would say that's fine if that's what the church itself has taught. But if the church itself teaches that there is a positive effect in this life, then we can hold the church to that standard. To say that the church is a valid religion, the church would have to be held accountable for its own thing. So the Book of Mormon says that there is a cycle of righteousness. If you're righteous, you'll get financial reward. So we can say, well, then we can evaluate a people and say that if they're righteous, they'll get a financial reward. And then we can hold that as proof to the church. Because we're asking to the church, what is your theory of the world? What is your theory of religion? What sort of things do you teach people will benefit from in this life? And then we can then check down that list and say, all right, by your standards, we'll see if these things happen. And that's what my list is.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
Don't smoke. There's a win.
No.
Check mark for Mormons.
In as much as ye keep these commandments, ye shall prosper in the land, right? That tees us up. That is the central promise of the Book of Mormon. That puts them in all sorts of scrutiny before us.
But you might start getting those wonderful blessings in the form of tribulations. You know, You know how that works.
Let's get out of the realm of theory and start talking about reality. So I mentioned my good friend Dean Paul. Dean Paul had a conversation with a Utah epidemiologist a year ago. And he said to this epidemiologist, he said, is there any epidemiological difference between the state of Utah and any other surrounding state? I.e., is there lower rates of infection, disease, anything that's marked that the center of CDC would pick up? I.e., is there a net effect of the church in a macro form on the overall health and well-being of the state?
Right, and it's a straightforward question, because you would expect that if God had some providence for his followers, you would expect lower incidences of house fires and car crashes and cancer and divorce and depression and suicide.
Absolutely. And particularly, we're talking about blessing and healing the sick. If you go hang out in a Utah hospital, you will see, and matter of fact, there are rounds that when I was an elder up in Logan area, we had a calling. We'd go to the med surge floor and we would go from room to room and ask people if they wanted a blessing. Unsolicited, right? And the hospitals know this. Talk to people who work in the hospital, and there are people up there giving blessings all the time. Like, not everybody in the state of Utah is getting a blessing in the hospital, but a statistically significant number of them are. So this epidemiologist, who happens to be a Mormon, the next question that my pal Dean Paul asked him is saying, well, how do you explain that as an epidemiologist yourself, that there is this thing going on, these blessings, but it has no statistical significance? The answer was, well, maybe the doctors are struggling and that is filling the gap so that it's bringing Utah up to the normal, i.e. there is no CDC evidence of the church. But if there were not people giving the blessings, then Utah would be out of pale and it would be at the bottom of the list.
Maybe.
It could, in fact, be.
Maybe the fact that the NSA has set up a new facility down the southern Salt Lake County, northern Utah County line, it's radiating magic photons or whatever, and that's – God, I hate explanations like that. It's crazy.
The answer then comes, what is it? Then you'd have to say statistically Mormonism would have an effect on doctors to make them lower. So either – in this choice, blessings do not work at all. Or Mormonism makes doctors in Utah so bad that we have to have blessings to bring them up to the level. I've used this example before, but it's a great example. There was an article that came out. It comes up every couple years talking about the high suicide rate in Utah.
Ooh.
The Utah has an exceptionally high suicide rate. And so an apologist a few years ago said, well, this isn't the Mormons. This is the non-Mormons, right? The Mormons aren't committing suicide. The reason is all the non-Mormons and apostates. Well, if you know anything about statistics, then you're saying not only does Utah have a high suicide rate, but if you're a non-Mormon, you have a suicide rate that's like 50 times the national average, which then somebody came in and asked, well, what is it about living next to Mormons that makes people so suicidal that they statistically will raise the whole entire level up?
Yeah, self-explanatory. Actually, there's some really fresh data that's come out that suggests it's altitude related. You read that?
That was, I saw that.
There may be some correlation, and they lined up a whole bunch of cities by altitude, and higher altitude cities. Well,
I didn't read the article. I saw the article, but how did we rank next to Nepal?
Yeah, I think it only covered like the western United States.
I mean, I didn't memorize the charts, obviously, but anything over about 3,500 feet above sea level, the rate goes way, way up really quickly.
Could be. All right.
Anyway, but it has nothing to do with like who's using consecrated oil.
That's the thing. So here Mormons spent a lot of investiture in blessing and healing the sick, and we see no statistical evidence of that whatsoever. Like, there's no, it hasn't been impacted, and I don't know of any peer reviewed study. Now, there's a lot of Mormons out there doing science. So I don't buy the idea that no Mormon has ever not looked into the fact
I've just been thinking of a wonderful Mormon science project. We could do a couple control groups with blessings with them using unconsecrated oil, see if there's any difference there. We'll have a group of the elders.
Double blind.
We'll tell them, yes, exactly. We'll have them say, you go in and give the blessing and say everything like you ordinarily would, but think about boobs the whole time.
So I was in the canola oil sample set.
Yeah. And we'll find out real quick. And then we'll ask the people afterwards, like, do you feel the spirit?
This is a major component of Mormonism, boots on the ground. Now, you know, if you're like reading New York Times version of the church, you won't read about consecrating and blessing the sick. But this is a huge part of cultural Mormonism and a huge testimony of faith. If you go to Fast and Testimony meetings, you'll hear story after story after story of blessing and healing the sick.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I remember reading, and I might be off because this is from my memory. I remember reading some years ago that 5% of cancers will go into spontaneous remission. This presents a problem for us as humans in terms of causality, because I guarantee you whatever voodoo that person was doing when their cancer went into remission, they are going to attribute. So you're talking about 1 out of 20 cancer patients will go spontaneously into remission scientifically, statistically, based on no external action.
That's the superstitious pigeon problem, right? You've heard that story. Mm-hmm. where they set up an experiment where they put pigeons in a little cage, and the pigeon could peck a little button and dispense a pellet of food. Got the hang of it pretty quickly, dispense a pellet, get something. Then they rigged up the button to do nothing, and the pellet would dispense randomly. And the pigeon who had learned to peck the button would peck the button and nothing would happen. And once in a while, it would peck the button and the little pellet would come out. And the pigeon thought, oh, well, I just spun to the left and it made the pellet come out. So if I spin to the left and peck the button, then I'll get the pellet. Awesome.
You can find videos of this.
Look this up on YouTube. It's awesome. Like black
it's like
and white footage.
Pigeons doing little pigeon rain dances.
Yeah, that's, and so they build on, okay, now I turn to the left and I wave my wing up and then I shake my tail feather and then I push the button and then the pellet comes out.
And clearly I've made the gods happy because I've been rewarded.
It's got causation between its action and the dispensing randomly of the pellet. And this is your cancer argument.
Yeah. So that's why we – as human beings, we're kind of hardwired to believe anecdotal evidence more strongly than anything else. And one thing that science has taught us is that's one of the least reliable forms. But everybody believes it. It's a really hard cognitive bias for us to come over and to overcome. And what it does with things like religions is it makes it so that everybody, every Mormon can tell you a story about how effective like blessings and fasting and prayer are. But statistically on the aggregate, we see no evidence of it whatsoever.
Well, part of the reason that those stories carry so much weight and why you feel them so tremendously is because you go about your life and you second guess yourself whether or not any of this works, whether the priesthood is real, whether God intervenes. And here you have a moment, a story, an anecdote where it really appears that maybe there is something there and your sacrifice isn't for naught. And it comes as such a relief, something to cling to. I think that's why those stories carry so much weight, is because they're so rare.
When you see this tendency, Oliver, I saw somebody on Facebook a couple days ago said, I have a Friday off, I need a movie to watch, right? And so the person was looking for Facebook friends to post something. And I bet that she picked one of those things. Now, you can go to Rotten Tomatoes, where you have an aggregation of all the critics and thousands of reviewers, which for anybody, that makes more sense. You're more likely, the star rating is much more likely to indicate whether or not you're going to like a movie than your friend. But we're biased towards people who are around us. And this is one of those things that religion preys upon. But if the religion were true, we would see some sort of epidemiological evidence. Now, there's going to be somebody out there who's going to respond to me and say, what about this article here? The problem is, in the aggregate, we're up and down. We're all over the map. So you have to establish what the null case is. And this is something they haven't done. So if you were to take 150 parameters of, say, mental and physical well-being, and then Utah tops out on 5 of them. So believers will say
they wouldn't even have to top out, right? Just simply well above average.
They're in the 90 percentile or whatever, something like
85,
that.
85, 75.
But the question is, if you take any random set of 1.5 million people in the world, what would be the average of them being on top? That's what I mean by the null case. So you can't just say, look, Utah is particularly good for longevity and for low heart disease, and therefore the word of wisdom is true. You have to say, well, what about Connecticut, or what about this part of Japan and whatever? You'd have to show that those bearings themselves are statistically significant. And as far as I know, that has never been done.
It should be really simple in parts of the country where there is a high active LDS population, where you've got just a high concentration of active churchgoers, and you can look that up. You can look up things like house fires, automobile accidents, cancer rates, divorce rates, suicide rates, depression rates, antidepressant usage. There's all sorts of data that you can look up right now today. Go to your computer and look this shit up and see whether or not Provo or Idaho, whatever, is above the national average. And they're not.
The statistical
problem. You would expect them to be there.
Of teasing out the population of active Mormons and then looking at these things is something a graduate level statistical student could tease out. It's not a basic problem, but it's not that complicated of a problem.
And it's not data that you'd have to dig up. It already exists. Go look it up.
Right, for sure.
If you're curious about the truth of the matter, look it up.
Okay, that's number one, epidemiological evidence. Number two I have on the list, it's very important, but it's just one that I've hammered to death, which is archaeological evidence. The church doesn't claim, let's compare it to Buddhism or Hinduism or something like that. There will be myth, or like a lot of Native American religions, there'll be myth that exists in a mythical space. You know, the corn mother did this sort of thing and the twins emerged out of, or Greek mythology, you know, Zeus castrates and binds his father, Kronos, right?
Aesop's fables, how the tiger got its stripes.
These things exist in a mythical space. No one is really claiming that there really is Olympus on top, you know, on top of, what is it, Mount Olympus? Is it
Olympus? Yeah, Mount Olympus.
All right. Sounded redundant to me. Because these things don't happen in time and space. Mormonism by its foundation in nature, claims a time and space element. With the golden plates and the prophecy and all the creeds are an abomination, this thing makes it concrete.
The most correct of any book on earth.
The most correct of, you know, that this is the altar where Adam sacrificed. And this is the literal Garden of Eden. And this is the River Sidon. And this sort of concreteness that the Mormons themselves, no one twisted the Mormons' arms and said, you cannot cop out like Eastern religions have done and claim this happens in mythical space. You have to claim concreteness. This is something to the point I started this whole mess out with, that the church laid for themselves.
Sure. The principal ancestors of the American Indians. Oh, I'm sorry. I mean the...
Among the
ancestors. Among the ancestors.
Yeah. I always want to know about the Garden of Eden being in Missouri. Is don't we just have to do like kind of bigger and bigger circles somewhere toward the west or the east gate? That's right, the east gate. We should find cherubim and a flaming sword and not be able to get past him, right?
It's a metaphor.
It's
well, they left during the flood. Checkmate.
Oh,
all right. So archaeological evidence, and I've go listen about building transoceanic vessels and other podcasts, and you'll
steel
see
steel and pollen and horses and God, there's so much that says. It's completely awful.
So, no archaeological evidence. We need to talk anything more about this.
I remember seeing a little wicker boat in the visitor's center at the temple that was very much like a boat that apparently they might have sailed in, possibly.
Well, and there's innuendo. If you go down in the visitor center, down on the bottom floor, they have these life-size dioramas. And there's they love this innuendo. Like, they imply that this happened in Mesoamerica. But they're not actually going to say it happened in Mesoamerica. And that there's a whole bunch of stuff like that. And what apologists do is they prove plausibility. They don't prove statistical significance. They don't, you know, they just say, is it plausible? And if you go get the old 1978 edition of the Book of Mormon, they're blue. You can get them at DI. There's tons of them. Go look at the pictures in the front. They have archaeological shots. And they'll have like a big pit. And they'll say, this could be a baptismal font. Yeah, it could be my mother's grave. But you can – and you can put anything you want there. But there's no accountability when you're just proving plausibility. And so every piece of archaeological evidence proves to plausibility. But the statistical probability of their plausibility is infinitesimally shrinkingly small.
I think that's not a issue about plausibility, but possibility. It's an argument that says this thing, this picture, this baptismal, or this cavity in the ground, it has the possibility of actually being a baptismal font. It's not...
See, well, if you found a hole in the ground and in it were like little rock temple recommends.
Well, this is the argument I was trying to make earlier, that people are desperate for something to hang their testimonial hat on, right? Throw out anything. The stones fit together. You couldn't fit a knife blade between them. Whatever archaeological evidence that you could throw out there, if somebody can hang their hat on that, good. You got someone that might stick around for a few more years.
If you want to see the cynicism around this, go to chief archaeological sites down in Mesoamerica. There is an enormous Mormon tourist industry. And these non-Mormon tour guides know the Mormon script and the non-Mormon script. And if you watch carefully for a while, you can see them do it. You can see them flip back and forth. And these people who have nothing to do with Mormonism will go through these sites. It should be criminal, but they'll go through these sites and talk about Lamanites and Nephites. And it's fantastic. All right. Archaeological evidence. The next one is messages for our times. One of the ideas behind a prophet, seer, and revelator, we'll come to prophecy in a little bit, but a prophet, seer, and later is this is the spokesman for God. This is the one agent on this planet who is authorized to speak for God. And I remember being taught lots of times that he was the prophet for the whole world.
Yeah.
He was responsible not just for Mormons, but for everybody, right? And we talked about this a little bit ago in our DNC, goofy DNC. that it trails off as the amount of progress, technological progress, which has created a whole new set of problems for us to deal with, has increased. The amount of direction that God has for humanity has likewise decreased. The church released a statement a couple weeks ago that's just crazy. They were talking about euthanasia. Did you guys see this?
I didn't.
So they said, we are for the medicine to prolong life, but we are against people using medicine to end their life because that's tampering with God's plan for when life should end. Well, how the fuck is one tampering with it and not the other, right? If God has a plan for me when I'm supposed to die, then if I end it shortly or extend it, I'm still messing with God either way, right?
Penicillin is part of God's plan.
How do they not see the irony of this stuff when they write it?
Every time you eat a meal, it's a middle finger to God because you're prolonging your life.
So, you know, here's things of our time, but those, that statement is not a definitive statement, and it's kind of goofy, but it is at least something. I mean, I have to give them credit. Most of the time, they don't have a lot of good messages.
No
for
substance,
our time.
Right? It's just generalities like, try harder, extend yourself, love more.
Don't steal.
And pay your tithing.
Don't smoke. Don't steal.
Go ahead.
Don't beat your kids.
Hey, I just wanted to chime in. My name is Kessie. And one of the things that ruined my shelf was basically in 2006, I just did my own personal exercise and like, okay, well, God is never changing, right? Okay. So what were the apostles and prophets doing in the New Testament, for example? Well, they saw the resurrected Savior. They were out raising the dead, healing the sick, taking care of the halt, the maimed, the blind, the leprous, etc. And now it's like, okay, that's the same fruits of what they were able to have. What do we have now? What are our current prophets and apostles doing along that strain of thinking? I don't know.
Running boards of directors.
Cured a ham, maybe? I don't know. I mean, I don't see any dead being raised. I don't see any miracles. I don't see anything. Yeah, this is my core horror moment. It's like, show me a sign. I mean, in my opinion, it's all priestcraft because none of them are authorized witnesses. They've never seen the Messiah. They have no ability to speak in his name. And if they do, it's like, what were the apostles in the New Testament doing? Oh, we saw him. He's real. They were screaming it from the top of the roofs and they were getting crucified and nailed to crosses. And what are these ones doing? It's much too sacred.
They're providing great value for shareholders.
The example,
well, yeah.
The example of what I'm talking about, you can find in a conference address by Gordon Hinckley. I believe, the spring session of 2002, it might have been a little bit later, but it was not long after the September 11th attacks of 2001. The United States underneath George Bush is gearing up for war. We're not exactly sure who to attack. This is when talks of yellow cake and just there are rumors just flying. Wars and rumors of wars, right? We have this situation where it's unclear how to act. The moment before the storm, the prophet, seer, and revelator gets up in a conference center with being translated in hundreds of languages, right? Where we have this voice of the world. And what he does, he gives this long, rambly speech about how we don't really know things. And it boils down to the long run. We have to trust our leaders because they know best. It didn't take very long before we proved that they didn't know what the fuck they were doing. And the whole thing has been a cluster mess from now until then.
Well, do you remember the April of 2001 before the September 11 attacks when they told us all to get ready that trouble was coming? Yeah, I don't remember that either.
But just so the idea of just leadership, being a thought leader, of showing some direction, right? Of this world is complicated in ways that it wasn't complicated in 19th century, that it wasn't complicated for Peter and for Paul. And where is the direction on, where is the leadership that we need?
So looking at cultural movements of the last 50 years, you can see we know now that clearly racism was a disgusting and awful practice. Even the church admits how backward and horrifying that was. You would expect that the leader on the face of the earth of God's will, the person who should be ahead of the curve in terms of morality and judgment and ethics and human decency would have been at the front of the human rights movements in the 1960s and not the absolute ass end by a decade in 1978. Well, that they would not have opposed the Equal Rights of Amendment. They would have projected it, that they would have asked for it, well, and this, clamored for it.
It gets to the heart of the thing, because racism is, aside from being disgusting and everything else, it's scientifically invalid. That's it's the real reason that racism is wrong.
Right. It's fabrication. It doesn't mean a damn thing.
But the church was right, and it had nothing to do with race.
Well, it's a great segue to point number four. Point number three is messages for our time. Point number four is very closely related, which is if the church were true, we would expect it to be progressive. Mm-hmm. So when we see the count, and you'll find very few people who would disagree with this arc of history over the last, let's just say from the Enlightenment, that we see a progression. Find me somebody who says from 1701 to now, we haven't seen social and cultural progression, right? Glenn in Beck. Walks Joseph Smith, 1805, right on the heel of the Enlightenment. And he starts spinning tales about the Nephites, when he's a kid, according to his mom. So you have this new age of leadership, right? But if you look at the church, take the major social problems that the world has dealt with, or at least America has dealt with over the past 150 years. And the church is either neutral on the side or invariably behind the issues all the time.
And by a lot.
By a lot. They were on the wrong side of the Civil War. Utah was a slave state. They were on the wrong side of the civil rights movement. We talked about this last week, that they were in conference telling the Mormons that civil rights was a tool of communism, right? These are the prophets, seers, and revelators. They were on the wrong side of the ERA in 1978.
Equal Rights Amendment.
They were on Vietnam. They were pro-Vietnam, right? In the early part of the church, they were oftentimes against the war. They were for prohibition, but Heber Grant got his feelings hurt because the Mormons voted to repeal it anyway. And we could go on and on and on where the church has been conservative, to its detriment over and over and over again over the last 170 years. And you'll find very few things that they are progressive on. I'll tell you the one that most people give them credit for. And I won't.
Oh yeah.
Which is the suffragettes.
Hell yeah.
But they were still being blocked. They were still block voting. That the Mormons saw this as an opportunity to get a lot of votes in.
I can make all my bitches vote to my bidding. Let's see. That's 14 votes for me. Awesome. Listen, wives, go vote for the guy I like. That's it. Like they had all the clout, all the weight. They could have their women vote as they wanted. One man, 14 votes. Awesome.
Let's do another thought experiment. Conservatism, in the abstract, means you like things the way they were before. Progressivism or liberalism means you're for change. You can take any point in time over the last 10,000 years, suddenly grab that time and say, who is more likely to be right at that point, at that juncture, the conservatives or the liberals? I don't understand why anybody would label themselves a conservative now, just on the sheer, like, statistically, I've only got a 1 in a million shot of being right, because the progressive people are always the ones who are predicting how things are going to be.
Conservative humping, don't you remember that they give the founding fathers, right? The conservatives love the founding fathers. Do you idiots now realize how liberal those guys were? Super liberal, super progressive.
Even by today's standards.
Oh, yeah, like, they weren't super big into religion. They sure as shit were barely Christian. Like, they were kind of deists, I guess. But they wanted a secular government. Like, why do you guys dry hump the founders and insist they were Christian?
Well,
they were liberals.
Thomas Jefferson, he actually wrote a version of the Bible in which he edited out every miracle, right? He took all the religion out of the Bible.
Yeah, he dug the philosophy of Jesus, but the miracles? Oh, give me a break. That's ridiculous. You're a grown man, for Christ's sake.
So progressive ideas. Where is the church on the forefront of anything? And they're spending all their money trying to roll things back, right? Prop 8 and all this stuff. It's not progressive. Give me a time when the church is progressive. They're always saying things are better back in the, and in the self-contradictory way. If you read conference talks from 1857, they're saying polygamy was ordained by God and it's been around the Bible and it's the way we need to be things. They were using a conservative argument. And then in the 20th century, they're saying we have to get back to traditional marriage. But they weren't for traditional marriage, you know.
They were the first guys on every block to get a satellite dish.
I just love that they've recently come around and be like, well, our early racism, that was just a cultural thing. Or our early, like...
Everybody was a racist back then. Yeah, don't be stupid.
Don't you see the analogy with gay people right now? Like, if it was a cultural distortion and a horrible mistake back then, what makes you think their leaders are any more equipped to handle decency and ethics now?
Okay, so number five is related. We talked about messaging for our time. We talked about progressivism, that we'd expect to see the church to be progressive on some front. The last one is prophecy. So we talk about the president of the church like he's the spokesman, like he's got God telling him what to do in the world today. That's what we were just talking about. But that's not what they claim. Joseph Smith goes into great detail to explain to you the difference between a prophet, a seer, and a revelator. They're not just prophets, they're prophets, seers, and revelators, and we still sustain all 15 of them twice a year. If you're a Mormon, you have to raise your hand to the square and affirm that you believe they are prophets, seers, and revelators, that they are fortune tellers, that they can see the future, right? So not just that they're the spokesman for our time, but they can actually peer into the mists of time and tell you what's coming. And what's wonderful is the old prophets were really great at this and predicting everything up until 1830 when the Book of Mormon was published. They had this foresight. They could name explorers and they could tell you what Joseph Smith's name would be. They predicted in Mesoamerica 1,000 years before Joseph Smith would be named Joseph. They didn't even have the name Joseph. Awesome. And they could still predict that his name would be Joseph.
That'd be a cool stunt.
But what is the last prophecy? I mean, it should be important, right? We have 15 prophets, seers, and revelators at the top, let alone the countless hundreds we've had, if you count everybody in the 15. What was the last prophecy made by the church? Anybody. There's a room full of people here. What was the last prophecy?
The proclamation
had no new information.
We need members to clean the toilets, I think. Does that count?
Hey, President Monson, I was thinking about buying a Ford. No. You get a Honda. Then you do and say, hey, well, I had almost no problems with that. You really knew his shit.
You remember in the Book of Mormon when you will find the murderer because his skirts will be covered in blood.
Dun, dun, dun.
Peter walks into the temple and says, money I have not, but what I have I give you in the name of Jesus Christ, arise, right? The scriptures are full of this shit.
Is discernment on there somewhere on your list? I can't remember.
No, we can lump that in with
prophecy. One of the things you would expect, if the church were true, is that the prophets themselves wouldn't be taken in by charlatans sharing or trying to sell them forged documents and paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for them. I would expect...
They weren't buying documents as prophets. They were buying documents as men.
Yeah, I would expect those men to be on top of that shit rather than forking over hundreds of thousands of tithing payer dollars to a con man.
So I would say...
A magical pile of money that nobody knows where it came from.
If you're going to claim to be a prophet, prophesy. If you're going to claim to be a seer, predict the future.
See.
If you're going to claim to be a revelator, reveal something. And otherwise, shut the fuck up. All right.
You know, I bet you I know what it is. Is that because the thing is, all the prophecies are happening. It's just that they all go to Curt and McConkie first.
I think they're more likely written by Curt and McConkie. All right. Let's see. Number six. Now, this is a model I've sort of used before. I don't know if I ever talked about it on the podcast. We have the West, right? The Mormons came out here, and you have like three cities. You have Salt Lake City, you have Denver, and you have Phoenix. Now, the environment's a little bit different for each, but they kind of have the same basic stuff to work with, especially Denver versus Salt Lake City. You're kind of looking at mirror cities of each other. But Phoenix has some resources that the others don't. They can grow some things, but it also has other hardships. So when you look at the impact of the Mormons, because the Valley blossomed like a rose, or whatever it is oftentimes used as Mormons as an affirmation that the church is true. So I would call it the Denver Phoenix problem. We're going back to statistical analysis. If you want to claim that the pioneers had special zeal or God gave Mormon special dispensation, what you have to show me is some progressiveness that exists in Salt Lake but does not exist in its peer cities. You have to show me something that happened that doesn't also happen in Denver and Phoenix. People will oftentimes cite that there's, look, we're up here in the desert blossomed like a rose, all these people live here, and that has to be the province of God. Which, they've never been to Phoenix, because it's a shithole, and there's like millions of people. I'm sorry, guys. I apologize.
Phoenix is great for like many months of the year.
It is great in around about now, and in February it's nice. But if you're there in June, it's fucking hot. That's my point. And you're down, and it's brown. It's very brown. So you're down there, and you have this city that's bigger than Salt Lake City, that has a better economy than Salt Lake City. Denver, in very similar circumstance, also blossomed. So you can't use it as a proof to say, look, we came here with nothing, and we built this great big city. So if Mormonism is set up as one of its tenets that we are building Zion on earth today, that we're not waiting, like the Jehovah Witnesses, we're not waiting for God to come and kick ass and then vindicate us. In Mormonism, it was, we are going to build the kingdom of God now. So where is it? You've been working on it for a long time.
We don't even have an NFL team, and both those other cities do.
But
hardly blossoming, jeez.
National publications point out that this, that's being Salt Lake City, is known as the gayest city in you know.
Blossom fabulously. Is that what you're saying?
Okay, I've read those articles. I've only ever read the headlines to those articles. I've never read. Okay. How do you become the gayest? Is it like the most, it's the easiest city to score a blowjob in on a Friday night? Like, how do you become the gayest city? You know, you have the most feathers? I don't, what exactly does that mean, the gayest city? All right.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the ease of finding gay friendly restaurants and clothing stores and bars and stuff, the strength of the community, the size of the gay pride parade. There's probably some actually pretty legit statistics that you could
use. If you live anywhere in the United States, there will be articles talking about how St. Louis is the best of this and Denver is the best of that. But is anybody taking notice and saying, oh my God, look at Salt Lake City. Incredible that they built that city out there. No. Because it's the same thing that happened all over the West, right? Sure, our ancestors worked hard and we built a pretty cool place. I like it here. But it's not exceptional. Like Salt Lake City is not particularly, it has its own patterns and its own things that make it appealing, but they're not something that's super special. There's no kiss of God in this city.
I want to rain on this parade a little bit. So I went to the trouble looking it up. Isaiah 35:1. King James Bible says, the wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. That doesn't anything say anything about being a unique requirement, right?
Well, okay, I know I've mentioned this before, but it's worth mentioning it. This is not a fucking desert, all right? There were several, there's rivers. They're all
Now. It's a desert.
There were trees. There was a landed settlement of Ute Indians down in Utah County. There was a Fort Buenaventura was up in Ogden. Like this place was already settled. There was grass and trees and stuff already in this valley. Like in the paintings, they will show it like the sagebrushy desert. That does not describe this valley. It was a fertile place. There were already people living here.
Oh, see, and then if I were LDS at that point, I'd just like fudge on what desert means, right?
Right.
We're definitely a high arid desert. That's beyond dispute. We're not the Sahara. We're not the Atacama, but we are a desert.
But you're using like scientific definitions of a desert. But when people
sure when it suits me, right? That's how my defense has to work.
Right. Right. Yeah. You're taking a term from the scriptures and applying a modern thing because then they work.
Right.
Right.
Right. When it suits me, not when it doesn't.
Exactly. Okay, number 7. And this is going to – some Mormons aren't going to like this, but so be it. Doctrinal insights that impress outsiders. Now, what I mean by this is if you don't already accept Mormonism to be true – and by doctrinal, I'll take everything we've already talked about and then anything else. Some kind of teaching, whatever, that is really impressive. Mormonism does not get a lot of press. It gets a wink and a nod every once in a while, and they'll mention, oh, look at the welfare system. Isn't that cute? But it doesn't get a lot of theological, in particular, note. The fact that the Mormons have an efficient method for growing and storing winter wheat does not prove to the fact that it's doctrinally sound, right?
Come on, they always roll out a family tree to the president.
They give, yes, their they thing. Give the genealogy to the president. But what, in my mind, you'd expect to see if Mormonism were actually true is some of its tenets, if not the majority of its tenets, would be noted by theologians. Now, some people say, oh, the church is too obscure or whatever. Listen, if you've been to graduate school, you're oftentimes looking for the obscure thing to write about. You're looking for a place that no one else has ever been. So if there were things that were theologically interesting to the rest of the world, they would have been noted somewhere. They would show up somewhere. But doctrinally, Mormonism gets very little play and very little notice.
Well, because you can't. Like, if you want to go, if you're a journalist or whatever, like, what do Catholics believe? Hey, Catholics, what do you believe? Here's a catechism. Take it home. Right? If you actually tried, as just an outsider, like, well, what is it the Mormons believe? You're swimming in jello in no time because nobody will fucking tell you. It's because you'll hear this stuff about other gods and planets and stuff, and then you go talk to the bishop. Well, no. Well, not a, you know, whatever. And then, like, the essays, everything. It's all just obfuscation. That's why you can't talk about it because you'd have to take a graduate course in it just to get anywhere close to where you could start.
That's the card any religion has to make, right? I mean, you mentioned the Catholic Church. Now you've got to look at infallibility of the Pope and the idea of limbo, right?
Well, no, the point is they state their belief. I'm not saying their beliefs make sense. I'm saying you know what they fucking are. With Mormons, you can't tell.
Right. But in the progression of theology, right, resolving the problem of the infallibility of the Pope and the idea of limbo, they've kind of created their own problem. And in the world of theology, being able to resolve that is a theologically significant and interesting idea to address. They have to bring something new to the table that resolves this apparent conflict. Mormonism doesn't touch anything in that land. They don't bring any new interesting ideas make theologians go, oh, that's an interesting new
take. No, they do, and then they won't cop to it. The Hinckley on the thing, like, you believe, you know, people can become like gods? I don't know that we teach that.
I don't know that we teach that. Because if I declare anything, you'll catch me in the trap.
I actually think, I agree with both of you. I think you both have great points. I think none of us were ever Catholic, right? But we understand, we have a conversational understanding of the concept of limbo. We can talk about it's good and bad, and we can talk about where it came from, you know, from Greek influence, but whatnot. But like, nobody can do that with Mormonism. And to your point, Flip, it's, you're absolutely right. You know, I've hammered on the fact that Mormonism sort of has an interesting solution to the Trinitarian problem. But you're right. I understand it because I've read a fucking lot of books on Mormonism, but most people can't even breach into it, right? And if you're a grad student writing an article, you're at Columbia University on here's Mormonism's interesting take on the theology of the Trinity, you're gonna have to write 170 pages to explain, and then some Mormon's gonna say, nah, that ain't what we believe.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if you just take a stake president, random stake president, or even better, temple president, and just get a line of different people to ask him what goes on in the temple, what does it mean from a 5-year-old, a Mormon kid. You know, and if you get all the way up to another stake president guy, that conversation is going to change every single time. You're going to get very different answers. Whereas I think a priest generally, like, you know, what does the Eucharist mean? Well, here's the catechism. It's the same answer I give every time.
I don't know that you can look to the Catholic Church in terms of, like, consistency of doctrine, right? Because tons of them look to the Pope and be like, oh, yeah, Pope's got it. And tons of them look at the Pope and go, oh, the Pope, he's adorable. He's like an old uncle, but who gives a shit? Catholic, here's how it really is.
The way the Catholics put it is that there's the three sources of truth, the scripture, the tradition, and the catechism. Mm. That's where truth comes from. And that's what the catechism is the codex of what we believe.
They're interpreted by definition, and every archbishop's going to have their own little spin, and there's no.
No, but it's there. Like, that's the thing, there's no equivalent for the Mormons. Like, you know, what is the Mormon view of Christology?
Yeah, there's no Nicene Council, there's no Vatican II, there's none of this stuff where things are solidified. And
what are you guys talking about? Like, the Mormons are more top down than Catholics by a lot.
So if I understand what you're saying, like, if you were had a PhD in Catholic theology, Brian, that people would say, what you're saying doesn't matter. There's no agreed on Catholic.
It's not
theology.
As top down. Mormons are strictly top down.
I think Mormon has become authoritarian as opposed to doctrinal driven. I think we've established that. Yeah. I think there is a corpus of Catholic theology that has a lot of writing about it. And there is potentially a corpus of Mormon theology, but nobody writes about it because it's uninteresting, is my point.
Well, it's not, I mean, it's not just that it's uninteresting, right? The leadership of the Mormon church does not specifically clarify fucking anything at this point. They let the apologists do all their dirty work, and they just say these kind of like empty basic platitudes like, try harder, be faithful, pay tithing, fat, fat, fat.
Every missionary in my mission had some similar story of having some question about the temple. Like, I went to the temple, had a question about it. My companion had no fucking idea. Zoni was no help. Called the president, and the president says, you know, that's a question for the temple president. Why don't you ask him next time you're down there?
I do have
a bunch of bullshit. It's not like he's got the door open. He doesn't take calls. You can't make an appointment with the guy.
It's not like he'd know anyway.
So I do have a question.
It's just made up.
Based on my Facebook feed, which is, why do we criticize the Mormon leaders for feel-good platitudes? But everybody's in love with the fucking Pope right now for doing the exact same thing. You know, he gets up there and does platitudes and everybody goes nuts.
Oh, no, I'll tell you why. Because he's saying stuff that historically Catholic popes have not said.
Yeah,
he's advancing things in the Catholic world that counts as progressive. He's going at least in a direction that I can sympathize with.
Which goes back to my point. The Catholicism is more interesting on many fronts than Mormonism.
I completely agree.
Okay. This one is going to sound funny, but again, we're judging the Mormons by their own standard, which I would say the next one is a conversion of a number of notable individuals, right? And what do I mean by notable individuals? I don't mean like stars of like 80s jet fighter movies. I mean that – You need to have individuals who have something substantial to say.
So you're saying Gladys Knight is not a thought leader?
No. But if there were 50 Gladys Knights, then it would hit my criteria. But a one random person is not statistically significant.
Or even something like, imagine like Steve Young. Everybody, we like to wave Steve Young, famous Mormon guy, around. If even like one third of the 49ers were Mormon by the end of his tenure there, because that's things you think all these football players, like, how's this guy do so well? Well, it's the garments. I'm going to get in on that thing. It clearly didn't work.
Right. Well, I'm going to cite two movies from the 80s the church produced. The one was On the Way Home, where they have this middle class, upper middle class family that's reasonable and well, you know, they kind of know they see the power of this message and they convert. The other one was, and I can't remember, it was part of the Book of Mormon, how where rare a possession, where there's this Catholic priest in Italy, who finds a copy of the Book of Mormon, miraculously has the title page covered off. And apparently he is very good at reading books, but not like reading the index or, you know, like you could go through, rip off the first three pages of the Book of Mormon and see how long it takes to figure out it's the fucking Book of Mormon. But,
it's in the Old Testament somewhere. I remember that.
Right. So this Catholic priest who just encounters the Book of Mormon finds the message so compelling that – now, I understand this is based on a true story. So I don't – I'm not going to doubt that this thing is true. But if that really has weight, why is that not happening all the time? Are we really going to make the argument that the tens of thousands of Catholic priests out there – are all so deceived that they are unable to see this? Because the subtext of the movie is that people are so biased just by the term Mormonism that if you actually removed that from it, then they'd all see how beautiful it is.
This is Kessie again. I would personally argue that Mormonism has probably the highest number of famous people involved. I mean, Hitler, Anne Frank. let's see, the founding fathers. Yeah,
that's
I
right.
I mean, you'd be shocked at how many.
Have we got the
forced conversion? Forced conversion goes a long way.
You're of course referring to baptism for the dead, right? yeah, and there's that there's a joke. I don't know who does it, but it's to get Mickey Mouse in there. There's an old Sunstone article that talks about how many times Mickey Mouse has had his work done for him, and they use all these different spellings. And if you go into the, up until like 5 or 6 years ago, you could go down to Salt Lake and search all the record, then they lock them up.
Oh, yeah.
And so the author had done all these searches to find all the different instances of Mickey Mouse that are in there.
Spirited discernment, huh? Yeah, sure, guys.
So what we would expect that I think most people, if you get return missionaries drunk, they'll tell you that the church really preys upon people who are disenfranchised, people who are oftentimes of lower IQ, of different social standing. Now, not everybody's this way, but they tend to prey on people who are in social need.
Oh, yeah. Funerals, for example. They explicitly state, oh, crud, is it that little white Bible? I can't remember which training manual, but it's Boyd K. Packer, I think, says something like, it's an excellent place to go find people who are spiritually hurting and ready, like, vulnerable and ready to hear any fucking idea they'll throw in their way.
So I would say that by its standard, because the Mormon church is a proselyting church. That's where they put most of their energy. They're out there trying to convert people. And that's what they really want. And that's what they use as a measure of their own success. Every spring, they get up and give their numbers. And they use the rough stone cut out of a mountain, da, 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 and all
stone
that sort of
cut
stuff.
Without hands.
And so we would expect to see people who are theologically educated, who are sociologically educated, who understand religion, who would take Moroni's promise. We'd expect to see a significant number of these quote unquote golden baptisms, but we just don't see it. They happen one off, but not in a statistically significant pattern.
I always heard I'm always wanted to look it up to see what truth, if any, there is to it, but there's a story that the church hired some Arabic scholar to translate the Book of Mormon, and he started work on the Book of Mormon, and he had this realization that this isn't terrible English, it's perfect Arabic, and he immediately converted to Mormonism because he knew that it was true, because translating it into Arabic was such a clearly Semitic origin, blah, 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 blah. And I remember hearing that, like, well, once the news gets out to the Arab world, this should be easy pickings, right? We'll solve this whole Israel problem, lickety-split. But obviously, they didn't all follow suit. Lots, you know, there's a billion Arabic speakers. None of them have picked up the Arabic Book of Mormon and been like, oh, wow, where'd this come from?
You guys remember, there was also an apocryphal story, I don't know if it's true or not, where these college students, I've heard it in different ways, these Ivy League guys were all drinking.
17 points?
We're all drinking, and they wrote down the list of the what the true church would have. Then they supposedly all independently found.
I've heard
the
a different version of this story, it's the same story.
So why isn't this happening like all the fucking time, right? Why it only happened in one dorm room once?
I think because I remember seeing that. We even like somebody, it was floating around our mission. It was like a little card with the 17 points. And occasionally we'd like try to bust it out in our fights with like J-dubs and whatnot. And that's the thing is like, you know, it's like, it's right there. It's laid out. And like you use it on them and they're none of them converted right there. Well, it didn't work.
I remember one of the stretchy points was, well, the true church of Christ will have his name in it. Like,
it's a low bar.
Anyway. Okay, so conversion of notable individuals. We're down to the last two. The next one is harmony, I would say, with solid scientific theory. What's interesting is the cosmology that Joseph Smith gave in the 1830s and 1840s kind of matched the scientific understanding of the time, at least a layman's scientific understanding at the time. But it hasn't fared well since. So either you can reject science and say, science really doesn't know. There hasn't been that much scientific progress from the 20th century. Or you can say, the Mormon church has a problem on this front. Because this is a revelatory religion. We're supposed to be restoring the truth. And if you look at the temple saying, okay, the veil was put on Adam's face or whatever it was. No, that's women. The veil was put on Adam's soul.
Remember, the veil is the cosmic vagina. We all learned from Brother Tannehill by which all things are made.
The veil is the sign of the vagina. That's what Mike Tannehill said.
Oh my God. He went on for 45 minutes and then for weeks afterwards.
I can guarantee you it wasn't a podcast I was on because I would not let Mike Tannehill go on for 45 minutes. So I don't know what you're talking about. There's this restoration that God keeps trying to put the truth back in the hands of man with Adam and then with Noah and with Abraham and Joseph Smith. And he keeps trying to restore this. So we have the restoration now. And this is the one time we're never going to fall into apostasy, right? So does this harmonize at all with scientific understanding? And the answer is not really.
So one of the things that, I figured out as my exit out of the church came from the idea of astronomy. I'm an amateur astronomer. I love astronomy. I love the scientific concepts that it tells. And I always was kind of hung up on the idea of whether or not the church was the young earth creationist. I thought, oh, it's just seven time periods, whatever. DNC 77 verse 6. Question. What are we to understand by the book of John which John saw, which was sealed on the back of the seven seals. Answer. We are to understand that it contains the revealed will, mysteries, and works of God, the hidden things of his economy concerning the earth during the 7,000 years of its continuance or its temporal existence. What that verse tells me is the church is doctrinally a young earth creationist church. Look it up. 77:6. It clearly is, and it clearly conflicts with everything we know about geology, astronomy, volcanology. We have trees that are older than this idea.
Never mind all that. What am I to understand by sealed on the backs of the seals? Sealed
on the backs? I think that's a 19th century farm boy's way of telling you that they put the signet.
I think he's just throwing words together because he thought it made it sound like Shakespeare.
But the point is, the church is doctrinally a young earth creationist institution, and you can look it up and see for yourself.
So, yeah.
Well, he wasn't prophesying as a prophet then.
Well,
prophesying as a man.
Death before the fall, right? That there was no death before Adam ate of the fruit. Well, you know, we know that there's plenty of organisms, for example, that just digest decaying matter. They don't eat anything else. Like, you can argue that I've heard argued, well, lions will have their stomachs altered such that they can eat grass.
So that their fangs eat. That's ridiculous.
But what do you do with parasites that just feed on dead flesh? You know?
Yeah. Crabs, lobsters, shrimp.
The spider planet.
Yeah.
Since I was a kid, I've been terrified of the celestial, because I just presume there'd be a planet for all the different kinds of creatures.
If that was
the fucking spider planet.
So the question is, if this religion is revealed, why wouldn't God say to Joseph Smith early on, in a way that kind of goes with our thing about prophecy and whatever, to saying, okay, guys, because it was common at the time to believe in the literal Adam and Eve story and say, this is just sort of metaphoric, right? That actually things have been around a long time. Like, God could have revealed that. No, but instead, God reveals what is commonly misunderstood. And you guys hinted this earlier before saying, oh, well, everybody's racist at the time. So God says, what the fuck? I should just be racist too.
Oh, they're all racist. I should just let him do it.
And say, and of course, I'll use my standard answer. Why didn't God tell them to boil their water? Right.
Okay. So
I knew there was a good reason I didn't like that guy, and it's because God doesn't either. What do you know?
I want to jump in with two references on that. One of them is a comedian named Jim Jeffries. Look him up. And Jim Jeffries goes, you know, if I was God and I was watching somebody write the Bible, I'd probably lean in at some point and go, oi, tell him it's round. High bar, right? And another one you got to go look up is a video on YouTube by a user profile named Non-Stamp Collector. And it's called What Would Jesus Not Do? And it's a council of angels sitting around chatting with Jesus about, like, the tiniest things Jesus could have done, like, wash your hands. Let's not do slavery. Women are equal. Like, just these tiny little anything he could have said would have been helpful to literally millions of people for the next thousands of years. That he just, I don't know, didn't get around to. Well, you know, I'll tell you what. I'm going to turn water into wine for a whole party.
So Joseph Smith's justification for polygamy was an angel with a flaming sword appeared before him and made him do it. That he had no choice. The implication, he would have been cut asunder with a flaming samurai sword into two burning stubbly halves had he not stooped all those women, right?
Hey, you got to take some for the team sometimes.
So God has this ability to intervene against obstinate people in very literal way. Like, if you don't obey him, he's going to send, like, the fucking hit squad down, and they're going to light their swords on fire.
Once he made that donkey talk to that guy, remember that one?
Yeah, Balaam's ass, yes. So God could have inserted one little place inside the Doctrine and Covenants or inside to show, in a way, because Mormons didn't, because some of the defense people have against some of the other things, well, Mormons is obscure people. People don't pay attention. Brilliant. What you do is you insert in an obscure sort of way some scientific theory that's not going to be hit on until the 20th century, right? Or 100 years later. And then you go, voila. Nope, not there.
Mass times the speed of light squared.
Okay, so the gospel is basically not harmonious with scientific theory. Now, they'll find big, long, metaphoric explanations, but let's be clear, it's not.
Well, Islam does that as well. You see apologists for Islam talking about verses in the Quran explaining the Big Bang, you know, centuries before that came out. interesting. I think it's called a propter hoc justification.
Yeah, Mormonism doesn't have any. All right, the last one. I call this the the psychological and sociological roadmap. So where religion, if you're going to retreat from all this kind of stuff, you say religion is not really about metaphysics. It's not about physics. It's not really about describing the way the world is. It's not really about describing the way the afterlife or the pre-life. That's all metaphor. All that kind of stuff is just hoo-ha, all right? But what religion really does is it helps us be better people.
Oh, my God.
This would be the defense that some people would dismiss the top nine I've just said and said, all that is just learning methodology. What the religion is really about is making people live better lives. So I would say then if the church were true, what we would expect to see then is that there is psychological or sociological evidence of the church's impact, that we would see that the things that psychologists are doing were already mimicked in the church, that our findings in terms of mental health, the church would have been a leader on those. But instead, we find things like the church is just barely not stopping doing this, promoting abused women to go back with their husbands, right? Punishing rape victims for not being sexually pure. There was a lot of resistance to like alcohol, recovery systems. They would just go pray. Like the psychological and sociological models for correcting human behavior that we've learned over the past 100 years, the church was not on the forefront of any of those. And in fact, much of what the church has been doing is cringeworthy now, and we're retreating from those things.
So one of the components that really frustrates me a lot about religions generally, Mormonism specifically, is the idea of heuristics. A heuristic is a shortcut to knowledge where you look at a single indicator and draw a conclusion. If a church was interested in making people more honest, more trustworthy, more caring, more compassionate, more generous, then it would look to things that relate to those ideas. What churches like the LDS Church do is it points to completely unrelated ideas, like a tattoo as an indicator as a person's morality. This is a broken heuristic. Caffeine usage, somebody who drinks coffee, is a bad person. That is a preposterous heuristic. There are people who drink coffee who are wonderful, moral, ethical and kind. There are people who drink coffee who are complete assholes. There are Mormons who don't drink coffee, don't have any tattoos, that are selfish, self-righteous, rotten, lousy people that you wouldn't want everyone to hang out with. Whether or not they're Mormon or whether or not they drink coffee or have tattoos or drink alcohol has nothing to do with the kind of human being they are. This abstraction, these bad heuristics that we say this equals that, coffee equals bad, beer equals bad, tattoo equals bad, leads people to the complete wrong conclusion about others, about themselves, and about how to evaluate the world around them. This is completely mistaken.
Everything you say is true, but there's another even more insidious thing that happens here. Imagine your neighbor has 10 kids, and he gets up in church and he says, "We're such great people. All 10 of our kids graduated from college." And or he says, "All of my kids graduated from college." And you say, "Wait a minute. I know your daughter, Lucy. Lucy did not even graduate from high school." And he says, "Well, she's no longer my daughter. We threw her out of the family. All of my kids have graduated from college." Say, that's fucking preposterous. You can't claim that you have 100% success rate if anybody who doesn't hit the successful criteria, you then eliminate from the pool. That's not only deceptive, it's moronic, right? It's to claim such a thing.
It's self-serving and dishonest.
Mormons will claim that they have a lower rate of adultery, that Mormonism helps families. But if you go to your bishop and confess adultery, what will they do to you? They will toss you out of the church, right? So they're manipulating the psychological basis of their religion. They're claiming, they're saying our religion helps people live better lives. And it better, because if it doesn't, we're going to throw you out on your fucking ear, right? You can't claim to be helping people if you're eliminating people that can't be helped from the population.
Well, this whole time leading up to this, the thing that was on my mind about what would you expect to see if the church was true, and I think about if you go downtown to the temple, pull into the parking garage, and you'll see a sign that says, you know, lock your car, not responsible for lost and stolen property. But that's still in the lone and dreary world. But then you get into the damn temple, and there's locks on the lockers in the changing room of the temple. And if anybody's been vetted, we know this person is honest in their dealing with their fellow men. And yet, like, this is supposed to be the holiest place that only the best of the best of the most moral and upstanding people can get in here. But watch your wallet.
I can excuse that because the foible's a man. But you leave the locker room and then you'll be confronted with the cash registers in the temple. That one I never could get around.
That one almost melted me. That was a shaker for me.
So
that you could spend money in the temple.
That's along the lines of the things that one of the ideas that came to my mind when we brought this topic up is the spirit of discernment. Right? You sit down with your bishop and they're supposed to, you know, already know this stuff. Have you ever tried to test that? Like, go ahead and masturbate all you want that month. And then lie to your bishop and see if he picks up on it. Test him to see if he's got the spirit of discernment. I can tell you, he doesn't.
Well, and then they put themselves into a situation like, have me interview a bunch of teenagers. I can tell you what they're doing. I mean, you know, like.
What a stretch.
Yeah, you know, it's not hard. thanks. All right. So psychological and sociological impact. I think. It was just this year that the church announced it's getting rid of LDS social services. I'm actually surprised it lasted this long. What does God need a starship for? And what does the church with the spirit of prophecy and revelation and office of the priesthood need a fucking social services for? And it's actually quite a problem in Utah that we have a lot of people who should be getting psychological treatment or mental health treatment or a treatment for abuse or other things that don't go there because the church is in its way. So what I would say you would see that there are better instances or of lower domestic violence or curing, especially that if the religion is the balm that comes in and deals with these social problems, what you would see is evidence that the church can come in and just clean things up. Again, we have no evidence of that whatsoever. All right. Well, that basically covers it, right? Like the church, if you were to take it away, you don't see any impact. Like it's the Denver and Phoenix problem. Do we have lower crime? Do we have greater health care? Do we have a better society? Do we have taller buildings? Do we have cleaner streets? Oh, we have cleaner streets. The church is true. But you don't see anything that's real significant, that it can't just be accounted for by the fact that different cities treat graffiti differently and different cities treat street sweeping differently and those sort of things. And we're not proof texting, just pulling little things out where we do not see a statistical impact.
Right. You would expect it to be correct about its past, to be correct about the future, to protect you, to offer you wisdom that you could not have got any other way.
You would expect the leadership to be progressive, to be intelligent, to be putting things out that are meaningful.
To be forthright and honest about its own goddamn history.
You would expect it to have something important for our time that you can't get from Tony Robbins.
So all of this makes me think about in the last couple of weeks in the Vatican, the Pope convened the super cross ecumenical crisis meeting on family values and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And the Mormons sent eye-ring.
Yeah.
And I mean, it just makes me think of from both sides, what the fuck does it mean if you're all of a sudden like, well, I wonder what the Mormons have to say about this and vice versa.
Well,
you think they'd be like, well, hey, we got it all under control. We got the pipeline to God. Just stay out of it. They're all getting together to be like, I don't know what our gods are thinking right now, but we need to.
Did you hear what Eyring asked for marriage? He wants more joyful marriages. Joyful. You know what another word for joyful is, right? Gay. He wants more gay marriages. Gayer marriages. More joy.
Yeah.
Was that a cheap shot? Okay, a little.
All right. So those are things you'd expect to see, in my view, if the church were true. And there will be faithful people who say, oh, it is a wicked person who seeks a sign. But I mean, the entire Book of Mormon is all about having a sign. It is a hypocritical and dishonest people that insist that they have a sign, and then when you ask to see it, say you can't see it. That's like what a big brother does to a little brother.
My right? God, that's like when if Edison were to go with his first try at the light bulb. Oh, you're asking for proof that it actually causes illumination. You just need to look by faith. Well, it took him 10,000 tries. Give the guy – evidence is okay to ask for.
Absolutely. All right. To the panel and to the audience, thanks. Good night.
The Mormon Expression Podcast is recorded live before a studio audience in Salt Lake City on Tuesday nights at 6:30. Come down and join the audience, take part in the podcast, and meet John and the panelists. The Mormon Expression Podcast is produced by the Whitefield Educational Foundation. Visit us online at whitefieldseducational.org to find out about our counseling services and other special events.